pleased to be here tonight and to see so many people that I have worked with or offered jobs to over time. In fact, we were reflecting about how easy it was for us to get jobs back when we were starting. So Paul's story of having four other offers was very common at the time. Unfortunately, the job market is not quite as good today, but I'm sure that you all will get jobs. That's what I tell my students all the time. I'm sure you will get jobs. Remember, you're investing in a career that's an important career, so don't worry about not having a job at day one. Work at it. It's worth it for the profession that you're going to be in. This profession has been extremely good to me, which is one of the reasons that I am involved currently in teaching, trying to give back something to the profession. But I'm also extremely interested in research, and particularly research that's international in nature, and I focus on support systems for the elderly. But typically when people talk about support systems, they pick one particular support system. So they talk about pension systems, or they talk about the long-term care system, or they talk about the healthcare system. And so you get different kinds of rankings for all of these systems. But from the point of view of an individual who's elderly and wanting to know whether the system will support them, it's not just the retirement system that you care about, it's not just the long-term care system or the healthcare system. You want to know if all the systems together are going to work. So the research that I've set out to do here is to try to see whether when you take all of the systems together, they are adequate, and after I've looked at adequacy, I then look at the question, so if the systems are adequate, can they be sustained? And this will take us through this research. Coming from the UK, they love to have a league table for everyone. So I'm sure you appreciate having a league table. I'm sure you can tell me where the Toronto Maple Leafs stand currently. But I bet you can't tell me where Canada ranks in terms of support for the elderly or where the United States ranks. And so perhaps at the end of this talk, you will be able to. So I've now done research with respect to 11 countries. I've been dealing with developed countries because it's easier to get data with respect to the developed countries. And I have been using OECD data. I started with six developed countries, but I've gradually expanded as I've gone to various parts of the world. And so I do have five Pacific Rim countries included here. I think you count Korea as part of your group, don't you? Okay. So of these five countries, which ones of their programs for the elderly would you consider adequate? All five? Three? Okay. So what I'm going to say is that you could classify Australia's program as often adequate, Japan's program as often adequate, or Korea's program as often adequate. And you might say, well, what does it mean, often? Okay. And so the methodology that I'm using is fuzzy set logic. And the reason for that is that we're going to look at a wide range of programs. They're not going to be completely adequate in every situation, and they're not going to be completely adequate or inadequate in every situation. There's going to be some range of adequacy. And so we're going to need labels like often adequate or likely adequate or likely inadequate or mainly inadequate, and we'll talk to that. So the three programs that I'm trying to assess altogether are what some would call Social Security. I'm talking about a retirement income system because that's part of what adequacy is. Do we have enough income? Okay, so that's a starting point. But income isn't enough to define the situation. We also require healthcare benefits, and some of us may require long-term care. So I look at these three in combination. And as I've explained, I'm going to use a fuzzy set approach because adequacy and sustainability sound like absolutes, but there are a lot of gradations. We're talking about programs that have many different variables. We're trying to apply them to a population that has great diversity. And so we're not going to have a single label of completely adequate, although some countries we will, or completely inadequate. So starting with the question of adequacy, my favorite Shakespearean play is King Lear. This is Comfiteor performing King Lear at Stratford, but he's out wandering around going mad, and the question that he's facing is, what is adequate? And he says, even our basest beggars are in the least superfluous. So there's always something that we have, and can it be called adequate, or should it be a higher level? So it's an extremely difficult job to define what adequacy is. And so the approach that I have used is to select four family compositions and to look specifically at programs that are delivered by the state. Okay. So I'm not including private savings plans or private retirement plans. I'm looking at it in terms of state delivered programs. Are those programs by themselves adequate? And in order to do this kind of comparison, I start with the income that comes from retirement programs that the state provides. I compare it to general expenses, and then I compare it to specific expenses for drugs and long-term care. I then determine a score. I average across these four family compositions, and then I come up with a ranking. Okay. So, family composition one, I'm looking at a couple, both of them between age 65 and 70. So these are the newly retired, if you like. And this may sound like an old style definition, because I'm looking at a situation where the male has been the one that's been working, that has earned the retirement income. But this is not an uncommon situation for today's retirees. Has had earnings at the average national wage. Okay, so why did I pick the average national wage? Well, we're trying to look at something that's adequate. And I'm not sure where adequacy comes in, but it seems to me that if you've earned the average national wage, then surely you should be entitled to something that's adequate, okay? But maybe if you've earned something less than the average national wage, you should be entitled to something adequate, but there we get into debates. But at this level, you should be able to, the average national wage. To simplify the problem, I exclude any other earnings or savings. I build in an allowance for drug expenses, and using information from Statistics Canada, but I have also tested it in the United States and some other countries. I find that the couple would need about 53% of average national wage just to cover their regular living expenses, including housing, food, transportation, clothing, etc. Family composition two, I look at a single female age 85 or older, and these people are what are typically called the vulnerable elderly. And so they do tend to be females, and they may live for another 10 or 15 years. And in this case, because we looked at a situation where the male had been the primary earner, this person is receiving a survivor's pension. And they have some of their own drug expenses, $1,200, and here general living expenses are 38% of the average wage. Once again, this is a Statistics Canada figure. Okay, and then the other two family compositions deal with whether long-term care is required or not. Okay, so if the couple one requires long-term care, then they fall into this family composition. If the surviving individual requires long-term care, they fall into this situation. And so we're looking at two different types of families, a couple that are just retired, an elderly surviving woman, and whether or not they require long-term care, and in all situations, I'm assuming that they rent. This is how I do the calculation to determine whether it's completely inadequate, completely adequate, or somewhat adequate, or inadequate. I have a number of different scores in terms of ranking country, so it can go from completely inadequate to completely adequate, and somewhere in between. And so these are the assessments that I got, and I'm up to 11 countries now, so they don't all show on one side, but picking this slide. So Australia is showing as often adequate. Canada is not adequate or inadequate. And so if we look at this couple that doesn't require any long-term care, Canada doesn't score very well. Okay. However, the long-term care that is available, that is provided through government sources, helps improve the situation for a couple that requires long-term care, so they move up. For a single individual, as a surviving spouse not requiring long-term care, once again, Canada doesn't rank very well. For a surviving spouse that requires long-term care, well, there is provision, and so the average is not very strong. So that's how we develop it. I will talk in more detail about these as we go along. Looking at Europe, you can see that the Netherlands and also Sweden are completely adequate. Okay. So a difference in terms of philosophy between Europe and some of the Anglo-Saxon countries. And you may say, well, this is built in to how you've done the analysis, because what you're looking at are state-provided programs, and in Sweden and the Netherlands, they have a much greater belief that the state should be involved and should be delivering programs, so they've developed them that way. Whereas in Canada, we don't think the state should be involved. We think things should come from private savings, or it should be the responsibility of individuals, or they should have insurance products. Okay, fair enough, but to get an understanding of where we're starting from and how we compare, we need to have a basis for the comparison. So in terms of Asia, Japan, often adequate, and Korea, often adequate, and you can see that once again, for an individual, or this is a couple, for a couple that requires long-term care, or for a surviving individual that requires long-term care, their systems are completely adequate. The score is one, and that's because both of those countries, over in the last 2 or 3 years, have improved their long-term care benefits that are provided by the state. So that made a significant difference. Is there anybody here that works in long-term care insurance? Nobody works in long-term care insurance. One. Okay. Good for you, because this is an area of developing need. Whether it will be a need that can be fulfilled by private insurance is a debatable issue, but it's certainly an area of coming need with an aging population. So in terms of the adequacy comments, I've mentioned the difference in philosophy in some of the English-speaking countries from some of the European countries. Another one of the traditional Anglo-Saxon beliefs has been that it's up to the individual to save for their retirement, and also that long-term care is an individual responsibility or a family responsibility. But with an aging population, and particularly with one where there are fewer and fewer children to support the elderly, the belief that long-term care can be delivered as a family responsibility is gradually breaking down. And in countries like Japan, which has seen the most dramatic aging of any country so far, and South Korea, which is going to have the most dramatic aging of any country going forward to 2050, they've seen that they need to introduce some formal long-term care system that's provided by the state, because there aren't the people there to provide it. When I look around this room, we have the right balance of elderly and young people here to make the system sustainable going forward. Unfortunately, this isn't representative of the population at large. Another item that can be extremely advantageous: Ireland provides a spouse's benefit through its social security system, to any spouse of an individual that's earned a benefit. And so the spouse doesn't have to have earned their own benefit. Canada has a similar kind of item through its old age security benefit, in that it delivers a demo grant, an amount of money, to anyone that meets the age and residency requirements. Because this is one of the difficulties in the system, is if you do not have earnings, then you're dependent on someone else, or perhaps dependent on the state. And just because you don't have formal earnings in the employment sector isn't to say that you haven't made a contribution to society. So in terms of recommendations with respect to adequacy, one recommendation is that there should be some form of a demo grant like Canada has, or a spouse's pension like Ireland has. And I'm surprised that in all of the talk that's been going about how we should revise our Canada pension plan, or introduce an old age retirement plan, or an Ontario retirement pension program, that there hasn't been talk about improving the old age security pension, because it goes to everyone that reaches the age. I would have proposed raising the age for old age security, for example, to about 80, because I think that most people can manage their planning for retirement with a horizon of about 80. But then I would have provided a benefit that might be 3 or 4 times the current benefit, so that it would carry on. And this would change the planning for people. Instead of having to try to plan for 90 or 100, you would only know that you had to plan your retirement as far as 80, which is a doable job, and thereafter there would be a pension. So, but that doesn't seem to be on anybody's agenda other than mine. The second recommendation is with respect to long-term care, and I did point out the differences in how some countries rank depending on how long-term care was handled. Long-term care is an insurance risk. It's one of the really true insurance risks. Only 20 to 30% of the people will probably require it, but if they do require it, it will have severe implications for their ability to afford their retirement income. So it is an important program to look at, but it can be provided in different ways. For example, Japan and South Korea use a mandatory insurance system. So everyone's required to have insurance, but it's insurance that is delivered using private sector insurance companies, but it's mandatory. Whereas in Australia and Canada, we use government subsidies with co-payments, and in Australia, they use means testing. So there are different ways to deliver it, but it is a benefit that is very important. And the third recommendation, and you probably noticed this when I talked about the level of general expenses, is for the married couple, 53% was required to cover general expenses. For the single individual, 38% was required to cover general expenses. So that's a 70% ratio. 38 to 53 is 70%. But in fact, the survivors' pensions that we typically deliver are not 70%, they're 60%, 66 2/3, 50%. So we need to improve survivors' pensions. They should be at the 70% level. So we've walked through adequacy. The next question is, if you have some system like this, is the system going to be sustainable? And so for these five countries, again, these Pacific Rim countries, how many of them do you think have sustainable programs? You're laughing. You know the answer. So Australia's system is likely sustainable now and potentially sustainable going forward. Korea, potentially sustainable. And the USA, potentially sustainable. Okay? So in terms of sustainability, there are two measures that I use. The first is it sustainable currently? So if there was no change to the program, could it just continue on indefinitely and continue to be sustained? But then the second approach that I look is it potentially sustainable? Because these are government-provided programs, and we all know that the government can make changes to the programs. We don't have to leave them the way they are. They can be changed. And the question is, if they were changed to become more adequate, would the country have the resources to be able to sustain them? So are they potentially sustainable? So I look at both current and potential. And for current sustainability, I look at what are the rates for Social Security? Is there stability of funding? So for example, the Canada Pension Plan is expected to be able to deliver its level of benefits at the same level of contributions for the next 75 years. So that meets the test of stability. Whereas in the United States, we continue to hear reports that the Social Security system is going to run out of money by the 2030s and benefits may have to be cut by 30%. So it doesn't meet the test. Another measure is the level of spending on healthcare. And so Canada spends in the area of 10 to 11% of its GDP on healthcare. The United States spends in the area of 16% GDP on healthcare, and costs are increasing. And so I look at this level to see whether it can be sustained or not. And the third measure is one designed to try to get at the idea of long-term care. This one's addressing retirement income. This one's addressing healthcare. This one is the ratio of grandmothers to granddaughters. Okay, so what's that got to do with long-term care, you say? Well, when we think traditionally, we've thought that families or individuals should be responsible for delivering long-term care. You know, that children or grandchildren will look after the elderly. Well, if, as in an aging population, we're having less and less children and less grandchildren to support the elderly, then we're getting an even greater burden of support pushed down. And the other thing that I measure is how dramatic the change in this ratio of grandmothers to granddaughters is. And so in Japan, the change in that ratio has been significant. So someone who's a grandmother now that was born in 1950, when she was growing up, thought it was quite reasonable to have grandchildren or children support the elderly because there were six or seven others of them to to help out with support. But now that she's a grandmother, there's maybe only one or two that are there to provide support. So they're not going to have the same view of how easy it is to support that this grandmother did. And there's a big change in paradigm. So I look at this as a measure of current sustainability. So in terms of our countries, Canada scores quite well on all measures, likely sustainable. United States scores terribly, likely unsustainable, okay? South Korea, possibly sustainable. Japan, possibly sustainable. Australia, likely sustainable. You can see all of them have healthcare spending in line. And here's this dramatic change in the grandmother to granddaughter index. Look at Japan. Japan's almost zero, okay? Very bad situation. If we'd look further into the future, we would see a similar situation for South Korea. In terms of potential sustainability, so now we're allowing for changes to take place in the system to make the benefits adequate, but the question is, can the system going forward support such changes? One of the measures is the old age support ratio. So when the old age support ratio gets too high, you don't have flexibility to make changes to support the elderly. Another measure is, what are your total tax revenues as a percentage of GDP? Mm. Once tax revenues get to be over 40%, then it's very hard to make any changes that will cost any money. This is a problem that France has. And then I also look at expenditure on public pensions, and I look at them at three different time periods into the future to get an idea of whether those commitments for future pensions are increasing, and consequently you're losing your fiscal flexibility to be able to make changes and support them going forward. And so once again, Canada scores relatively well on all measures. Our population is aging, but not that severely. Our tax burden, believe it or not, is pretty light. Okay? And so we score here. But the big change, so we've looked at the United States, we've said they have inadequate programs that are completely unsustainable. But the good news is they could be sustainable in the future. The United States does not really have an aging population very much. It continues to hover around a birth rate of about 2 per woman, and they also have reasonably strong migration. So they don't really have much of an aging population. Even though their main message is no new taxes, they have very light tax burden comparatively. So if they could get over that, they have lots of room to increase taxes to provide support. So they actually score very well in terms of potential sustainability. Australia scores very well. Japan, you can see Japan's biggest problem here is its aging population. Okay? So that's its biggest challenge, is the aging population, but its tax burdens are not high and its public pension commitment isn't great. Okay. So, overall assessment, the top three, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Australia. The bottom three, England, France, and USA. So let's look at these six countries just to see why do they rate this way and what can we learn from them. The Netherlands has very high pension income.
Okay, that's a good start if you want to provide for adequacy, have high pension income. They also have a strong long-term care system. In terms of sustainability, their pension funding is not completely stable, although it is pension funding that other countries are looking at, because it's established as though it were a defined benefit program, but it has an adjustment mechanism. So one way that it can adjust is by reducing the indexation on pensions. Another way it can adjust is by increasing the rate of contributions. But as a result, if you can increase the rate of contributions, you don't have a stable funding system. Okay? It has well-controlled healthcare spending, and going forward, its advantages are aging is not very severe compared to a Japan or a Korea, and it has a moderate tax burden. Sweden, the state provides adequate income, and the system is a stable funding system. Sweden have switched to what is referred to as a notional defined contribution system. And so there, it's like a defined contribution system in the sense that you contribute 18% along with the employer in total as your contribution, but it's different from a defined contribution system in that the state uses the money that's been contributed to pay current pensioners. So it's like a pay-go system in that respect, and that's why it's a notional defined contribution. But it has a balancing mechanism in place. So in the case of the Netherlands, where they balance both with respect to index pension and also with respect to contributions, this NDC system only balances with respect to indexation. Okay, so it keeps the contribution level the same. But the other feature that it has in its system that helps to make the system stable is it's continuing to move the retirement age for a full entitlement out into the future. So as the population ages, you need to be living to an older retirement age in order to qualify for a full pension. And so it's automatically building in an affordability mechanism. One of the things you would have thought about Sweden is that huge taxes. We've all heard stories about the level of taxes that have to be paid in Sweden, and while of the countries I've studied, its taxes are at the highest level. The taxes are actually starting to come down. If you look at over the last 5 years, Swedish taxes are gradually coming down. And compared to France, they're very close in terms of tax rates, but French tax rates are going up. So, what's the situation there? Australia. Has a significant state pension, but the state pension is delivered on a purely defined contribution basis. And in the period up to about 5 or 6 years ago, everyone thought it was the greatest system that anyone could imagine, a defined contribution system with high rates of return. Isn't this wonderful? Unfortunately, we're no longer in a high rate of return environment. And so there are starting to be some questions about whether the Australian system of pensions is really as good as people thought, okay? Because it may not be able to deliver. And they are talking about the possibility of having to increase contributions. They changed their long-term care system in the last 2 years. So that they do have a strong long-term care system. And they have relatively low taxation, so they have what I would call lots of fiscal room in order to make changes to be able to support the system. So those are the top of the list. What about the tail end of the list? England. Very, very low state pension in England. Okay? And once again, this goes back to the philosophy of, you know, we don't want to give them state pensions because they might not have any incentive to work beyond welfare. So make them save for themselves. And then if they really get into trouble, then we'll do means testing. And if they're really needy, then we can provide support. So it's a completely different philosophy. But it still results in a relatively low state pension, even with the changes that they're talking about to their state pension. And it's been changed three times in the last 5 years. Long-term care costs are borne largely by the individual. In England, they've recently had a commission, they've made changes to the long-term care system that will come in 2017, but it still effectively has a deductible of £75,000. Okay, so you gotta pay the first £75,000 yourself before the state kicks in. And not only that, there are effectively inside limits, so you need to be paying the first £10,000 a year yourself to count towards this limit. So it still leaves lots of room for private insurance, but it puts a lot of burden on the individual. There are questions regarding the stability of their Social Security funding system, but they do have room to adjust. France is what I refer to as a basket case. Okay, it has a final pension that requires long service and uses long averaging periods and price valorization. But they allow people to retire at quite an early age. So age 60, you may recall that the previous president tried to raise the retirement age to age 62, and there were protests, people in the streets, it was rolled back. Very expensive system when you have an aging population and you're keeping your retirement age at 62. So their Social Security rate won't support full benefits over the actuarial high horizon. They do have a long-term care system, but it requires 24,000 euros as a deductible. Okay, so that's not as bad as England, but it's still relatively high. They do have a relatively rapidly aging population. Okay? Part of the issue has to do with the wars. Okay? When you kill off a lot of your young men, your population ages rapidly. Okay? And so this week I was in Munich and we were looking at population pictures, and countries like France and Germany have these really jagged population triangles because of the wars that have taken place that just cut parts of generations out and leave other ones that are longer. And France has very high taxes, almost at the same level as Sweden. Their taxes are going up. They also have significant commitments to public pensions going forward, so they have very little room to move. Okay? So for me, France is the basket case. The United States, despite all the fury that we hear over their Social Security benefits, they are modest Social Security benefits compared to many other countries. So they're, in terms of adequacy, they don't do well. The changes that are taking place to the healthcare system will help somewhat, but they have an extremely costly healthcare system. They pay at least 5% of GDP more than all other countries pay for healthcare. So that's an added burden. And long-term care costs are mainly borne by individuals unless they have such severe need that they get it through Medicaid. Their Social Security rate won't support full benefits over the actuarial horizon. Time horizon benefits funding runs out in 2030s. The way the law is written, if they haven't been able to negotiate any change in the contribution rate, when the funds run out, they just cut the benefits back. And healthcare expenditures are high. As I said, they're not aging very rapidly. They have very low total tax revenue as a percentage of GDP, so they could make their system sustainable and adequate. But the big question is it possible politically to raise taxes in the United States? Probably not. So they're stuck with a system that is both inadequate and unsustainable. So Canada, our Canada Pension Plan benefits are modest. That was the way that they were designed in order to give opportunity for private savings and for private retirement plans, employer-funded retirement programs. As I said, I haven't included those other forms of savings here. I'm only looking at the government plans. But our Demogrant, the old age security benefit, does make a difference because it provides income to those who haven't had earned income or may have had disruptions to their earned income through health or some other area. And we do provide long-term care support for those with lower income. Canada Pension Plan is funded well on a level basis. Our healthcare expenditures are in the 10 to 11% range. There is the danger that those costs can increase, particularly with an aging population. So we do have to be watching this. And we do have room to make adjustments in terms of our fiscal commitments. So in terms of future research, I would like to be able to include private savings, employer-provided benefits, family support. I have a proposal with a number of other researchers out hoping to get funding for so that we can expand the research in that area. So I think that would provide a much fuller picture than what we've got here, which is based solely on government benefits. I would also like to have a model that could test social attitudes. So where I say, for example, that the United States has the potential to make their system sustainable, it seems unlikely that they will because of no new taxes. But I can't incorporate that directly in the model I have here, but I'd like to be able to incorporate that going forward. Are there any questions? Yes.
I'm very interested in the way you brought this up, especially in separating advocacy for being able to survive for the individual as well as sustainability by the government to pay for things. And one of the concepts that popped up as a result was, I know, for example, early or late, it's essentially actuarially equivalent, so that talks to sustainability. But the part that isn't really ever talked about, especially for countries like Canada and the US, is the fact that a lot of people don't ever achieve full benefits for many reasons. One of them being a lot of people immigrate to the country, not enough years, et cetera, et cetera. And also the nature of work is no longer lifetime employment. So one of the factors I would like to see applied to adequacy is statistics and the percentage of the full benefits that are actually in other countries to get an idea of where, let's say, the bottom end, below 65,
I hope you were able to hear that question. Okay, you weren't? I'll try to explain that. I should have had you do the introduction instead of Paul Chow. You would have set up the audience so much better. Okay, her question is, yes, we know what the levels of full Canada Pension Plan benefit are, or what the levels in the United States of full Social Security benefits are, but these benefits are based on earnings levels over a career that may have had interruptions in earnings, and they're also based on a full period of work, whether it's 37 years, 40 years, whatever the number is. Many people don't have that length of time. Perhaps they've been raising children, perhaps they're immigrants to the country, various things like this. And so it's one thing to look at adequacy and sustainability based on full level of benefits, but what's the situation for many other people who are at partial levels? Is that your question? Okay, so the reason that was such a great introduction is it illustrates the difficulty of trying to do this analysis. Okay, and that's one of the reasons for using fuzzy sets, okay, because we can't just pick one situation and say, okay, this is how a whole country's programs are. But I had to do that in the measure, and so I picked someone that had a career's earnings at the average wage on the basis that for that person, the system should deliver something that's adequate, recognizing that if it couldn't deliver something that was adequate at that level, then it definitely wasn't going to be providing something adequate at the levels that you're talking about. But you're absolutely right. That's a good way in which to extend this analysis to try to look at more than just, you know, four family compositions under a specific way of a set of earnings. But thank you, that's a great question. Yes?
If you start expanding to other family situations, then you start have to look at Social Security benefits, because in Canada we have some kind of guaranteed income. So to the extent of pension earnings
are not
valid,
you
actually have that Social Security.
Yeah.
Welfare.
Right. Yeah. So that's a very good point as well. I am not including the guaranteed income supplement because I'm looking on the guaranteed income supplement as though that is a benefit that's delivered in the event that other benefits haven't been able to deliver. And so I've tried to pick a situation where I think the designed benefits should be adequate and you wouldn't have to fall into the situation of guaranteed income supplement. But you're right, the guaranteed income supplement does provide some support from the bottom. So if you haven't had adequate benefits here, it doesn't mean you drop all the way down to the bottom. You may fall less far. Whoa.
I've got a question. You talk a lot about, we all know about this, aging population of different countries age at different rates, and that depends a lot on fertility rates and the wars in France, etc. What I'm thinking about, though, is that it's not necessarily an absolute, because the age of the population may change because of immigration. You might have very low immigration or very high immigration. You know, typically you think of Germany and France as very old populations and not very open. But, you know, things can change suddenly. You might have 1 million Syrians, for example, come in. And it depends whether they get high-paying jobs or low-paying jobs. They could be a burden on society, or they could be helping solve the problem. So that's one more aspect, I think, of fuzziness that probably hasn't been factored in.
That's a very good point and very real to me, because I just came back from Munich. I was visiting the Max Planck Institute of Social Law and Social Policy And the leader of that institute is Axel Borsuppen, who's giving advice directly to the minister in Munich, and he was going to a meeting to discuss the issue of migration into Germany. And his personal view was, why shouldn't we have another million? Germany can easily accept another million. You know, we have 81, we could have 82 million, and there's still lots of jobs for them. But when I was asking that kind of question to people like Rob Brown and Bill Robson 20 years ago, I was told, a million people coming into a country, wow, they couldn't possibly do that. That's an incredible number of migrants and so on. But interestingly, Canada has done reasonably well. I'm not sure about you, Mike, but I grew up thinking, you know, that 30 million would be a big number for Canada to have, but we're up to 36 million now, so we have accepted a lot of migrants. And so yes, migration can change the dynamics of a country. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that the United States is not aging very rapidly, because it has many Spanish-oriented migrants that tend to have larger families and bring down the average age of the population. So yeah, migration is an answer to aging. I think this was a question here.
When you started this presentation, I almost thought that at the far end of not being sustainable would be the Japanese system. And yet I see all kind of statement they're saying the Japan system are likely sustainable. So I'm scratching my head, right? I said, my perception of what's happening in Japan appears to be different from what I'm seeing here. What I see in Japan is that their debt to GDP ratio is like over 200, which is like the highest in the world. Their demographic, the people are aging very fast. It's unlikely that Japan would take massive immigration because they don't like immigration. So maybe you could elaborate the situation in Japan and how is it that the system is sustainable?
Okay. Okay. So there's no question what you've said is correct. So in terms of their fiscal burden, for example, their commitment to public pensions going forward, committed spending is reasonably high, so their score, you know, 0.5 is not very high. So this is taking into account commitment. In terms of debt, that isn't one of the factors that I've measured. So maybe that is another factor that I should include in the analysis. Yeah, their debt is high, I understand. So I haven't included that. In terms of their aging population, you can see that, yes, once again, they score very low in terms of aging population. So 0.28, yeah, is very, very low. But their tax burden is not heavy. Okay, so they have room to make things sustainable. But let's go back to current sustainability. Current sustainability, their pension system is undergoing adjustment. They have built in automatic adjustment mechanisms so that they're gradually adjusting the benefits that you get based on your life expectancy. Yes, as you mean, Sid, cutting them down.
Yeah, because they leave long.
But it does mean that they are relatively stable in terms of their funding. Their healthcare spending is not that high. They have one of the better percentages spent on healthcare. They scored very low on this grandmothers to granddaughters. So here they're scoring, you know, not very high on current sustainability. So they're doing better on potential sustainability than they are on current. current sustainability.
Does the healthcare spending factor that you have there include a projection in terms of the aging population that they have? Or does that, is that just one snapshot of the existing condition?
This is based on current levels.
Okay. If they're aging, then that would go up.
Yes. I thought I saw a hand over there. Okay. Oh, there was a hand over there.
Well, I'm putting up my hand. I have a little problem, I guess, with saying the Australian system is so great for this. If you go into their funds, I mean, most of the people just take a lump sum and buy a retirement home and then take their chances with the government pension down the road. That doesn't seem a good system. What is that sort of factored into this? What people are actually doing with some of the money that they're
making? One of the colleagues that I have from Australia makes exactly that point that he's very concerned about. So what we're looking at is the amount of the lump sum. Is the lump sum adequate? And the answer is yes, it's pretty good. The lump sum's pretty good, but if you spend the lump sum traveling around the world or buying a big boat or whatever, then no, it's not going to be there. So that would be one of the kinds of social attitude things that it would be nice to be able to measure, and, you know, like, do people do the right kinds of things? Because in many countries, you're not able to take a lump sum, so effectively you're controlled, you are getting a regular pension income. But in Australia, there's no constraint. You can take a lump sum and you can blow it, so you're right in that respect. But I'm not incorporating that element of human behavior in the analysis. I expect people are ready for dinner. Okay, thank you very much.
I just have one.